Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the code used successfully by Newt Gingrich in his South Carolina win that he himself attributed not to his superior debating skills, but, quoting, "I articulate the deepest felt values of the American people." Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief Adele Stan joins us to decipher Newt Gingrich's race-baiting code and discuss what she sees as the likely rhetorical refighting of the Civil War, with a black Democrat doing battle with a white Republican for president of what is supposed to be the post-racial United States. Then, with today's announcement that the European Union is joining the U.S.-led embargo against Iran, we will examine the role of Iran's largest trading partner, China, in avoiding another Gulf War and the closure of the Straits of Hormuz. Min-Sing Pei, the director of the Keck Center for International and Strategic Studies and a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College, joins us. He has an article at the BBC, China's Iran Dilemma. Then finally, Joshua Landis, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and the author of Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics, joins us. We'll discuss Saudi Arabia's withdrawal from the Ineffective Observer mission and the Arab League's demand that Syria's bloody dictator Bashar Assad hand power to a transitional government, a demand that the regime has already rejected as a foreign conspiratorial scheme. And joining us now is Adele Stan, who's Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has served as a columnist and blogger for The American Prospect Online. A featured essayist for The Guardian's Comment is Free Site, a contributing writer to Mother Jones and Washington correspondent for Working Women. She has an article at alternet.org, Gingrich and Race Baiting Wins in South Carolina. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And Adele, the front page of Monday's LA Times says GOP's head versus heart battle suggests that the Romney represents the head and Gingrich the heart. So which organ is going to conquer?
My goodness. Oh, if Romney's the head, they're definitely in trouble. And if Gingrich is the heart, I mean, he seems a rather heartless chap to me. That's a kind of, I don't know that I would buy that analogy.
Well, it comes from a quote from Republican pollster, Whit Ayers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I just, right now, I think the Republican Party is rather headless, rather like a chicken that has just been beheaded. I mean, it's running around, not kind of knowing what it's doing. And the reason that's happening is, you know, we hear all this talk about the Republican establishment, but there really isn't an establishment that has any real power anymore. And there's a new establishment rising out of the Tea Party. So, you know, it's sort of in this place of shifting. In terms of Gingrich being the heart, well, I mean, I think maybe Gingrich is more like the ganglia. Gingrich is more like the autonomic nervous system that is propelled by fear. You know, maybe he's the amygdala. I don't know, but he's really stoking the fears of a certain segment of the GOP base, which he knows will respond to fear of the other, whether that's African Americans or gay people or radicals, whomever. And that is how he sees his path to victory. And there's an African American president, and in the South you have a race problem, and you have the base of the GOP, thanks to Richard Nixon's Southern strategy, being largely drawn from people who are not comfortable with changes in civil rights law and things like that. So that's where we are.
So Adele Stan, he's now in Florida, where apparently Mitt Romney's, there's 200,000 absentee ballots already cast,
right,
which the assumption is that mostly for Romney. Mm-hmm. But it does seem that Gingrich is already doing well in the polls in Florida. He'll clearly do well in the panhandle. And then following Florida, there's a bunch of southern primaries as well. where he will employ the same strategies that he that were so successful in South Carolina.
Right.
So, you know, this is one of those things where progressives may end up ruining and getting what they wished for, which is somebody that the pundits have said is weak compared, you know, that Obama will have an easy time with than he would with Romney.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I think that either way this slices out for the Republican Party, there are going to be just terrible problems for the party itself. You know, if Romney wins the nomination, they have a very, very damaged nominee. If Gingrich wins the nomination, then you have this really, you know, bellicose and divisive face on the party. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, neither one of these guys could come close or even win. They could. I mean, a lot can happen during the course of a presidential campaign.
Things like the Euro crashing or a war with Iran? Or,
yes, any of those things. Or you know, another stock market crash in the United States.
But even if that doesn't happen, I still think that Gingrich is formidable. I think the Republican establishment, and you mentioned it's largely a myth, but I think there are a few people in the back rooms that are having palpitations at the thought of him being the leader, because in conventional political wisdom, he's damaged goods. But it doesn't seem to matter, and that's what I find extraordinary about the code that he speaks to the American people with, or at least to his followers with, and you've written about it in your article at Alternate, Adele Stan. I think it's working, and I think there's an awful lot of angry people out there, angry white working people, the so-called Reagan Democrats, not to mention the Southerners. I think this guy's got a good shot.
Well, I think he possibly could. You know, he's got a couple of actually mechanical problems in that he's not on every ballot. He's not on the ballot, for instance, in Virginia or, I believe, in Missouri. So he's got some of those hurdles to overcome. But if he did win the nomination, I mean, Gingrich is, you know, it's not for nothing that he's been called a great tactician. He is a great tactician. When Gingrich fails, it's when he, you know, he gets ahead of himself and begins to think he's a great genius. But he is a very keen tactician, and he's very clever with framing language. He always has been, whether it was with the contract with America in 1994, or what he's doing now in already defining Barack Obama. He's not even bothering all that much now that he's damaged Romney so badly about talking about Romney. He's talking like he's a front runner, and his target is Barack Obama, whom he is really already very well around the corner of defining with these false dichotomous you know, choices where, you know, he casts Obama as the quote-unquote Saul Alinsky radical, and as opposed to people who love America.
Right. Well, that's a sort of shades of Sarah Palin. But it seems to me that at the heart of what the Republicans are doing, and even Romney goes on a somewhat sort of prissy rant about Obama, it seems to me that at the heart of this is that they can't say they hate him because he's a black man. So they make up all this insanity about his birth certificate, him being born in Kenya, that he's a Muslim, that he's a socialist, that he's a follower of Saul Alinsky's. They've actually invented an alternative to the fellow that's actually there in the White House, this mythical figure that they are giving people permission to hate.
Right, but in every one of those instances, he is somehow being defined as other, and that is the key. And then when you take the whole trope about food stamps, the food stamp president, I mean, that's an evil genius right there, you know, fusing all of those ideas together, because, of course, it's an old racist trope that the only people on public assistance are African Americans. And so that codes Obama that way. But then when asked, Gingrich then follows up with a lie saying that, Obama has put more people on food stamps than any president in the past. And, of course, that's not true. George W. Bush did. But
right. Well, this is the historian speaking, right?
Right. Right. This is according to Newt.
But he doesn't care about facts. He really is quite cynical. But what he does is so he connects with these people in this code that I find extraordinary. Not just the race baiting nature of the code, but when he was talking about the other day, I think as his acceptance speech in South Carolina, about what the establishment and the media don't understand, and he almost prophesiarily said, "Now listen to what I'm saying, that you don't understand that for the last 30 years you've been trying to turn America away from what it really is." Now, what the hell's he talking about?
Well, I'm sure each of those people in his audience have a
They
had a
knew
good idea.
Because they gave him a rousing applause. But what is he saying here that somehow that America is not a right-wing patriotic country?
Well, I mean, if you think about what America was 30 years ago, 30 years ago, we had not yet had the first woman Secretary of State. We didn't have women in those kinds of positions of power, or a woman who was a presidential candidate who was a serious contender. 30 years ago, we didn't have African Americans in positions of such visibility in the media. Or in power in general. 30 years ago, we're talking about Reagan time. So there's a lot going on there, and you can.
Well, no wonder he can't say it. I mean, that kind of ridiculous racist nonsense has to be said in code, surely.
Right, and also, you didn't have gay rights 30 years ago. So, I mean, in couching it the way he did, it's sort of an equal opportunity, catch-all for anybody's fear and resentments of changes that have taken place that mostly involve the expansion of rights for people who have been oppressed in the past.
And the idea of a European welfare state, I guess that's just thrown into the mix for a little extra zing,
well, again,
right?
Again, we're talking about the other. When you talk about European, it's other. And
right. Well, you've broken it down in your article, Adele Stan, at Alternet, in a very succinct way. You say Europeans equals secular foreigners. Dependency equals welfare. Welfare equals lazy. Welfare equals black people. Food stamps equal black people.
Yeah, I mean, and you can go on and kind of, decode it, as you go along. But yeah, I mean, that's where we're going with this. And
that's where the country's going. This is not just going to be a nasty electoral campaign. It's going to be really about the dark side of America emerging in a kind of reactionary snit.
Yeah, I mean, I've been actually, saying for a while that the Civil War is not over. It's just not over. Now, it doesn't. I'm not saying it all breaks down into North and South, but you have such a deeply polarized population where it really is. We are divided culturally, and there are forces that seek to maintain that division.
So, given that at this point, we can't get ahead of ourselves and assume that Gingrich has already got it because he's got a pretty high bar to get over. He's not on a couple of ballots. I assume that if it's still going to at the time of the convention, he could have a very powerful case against the states that don't have him on the ballot. But just looking ahead at it. Who do you think's got the strongest argument? Mitt Romney, who is saying, "I'm the businessman and the guy in the White House is out of his depth and I can fix the economy," or Newt Gingrich with his racist code and this atavistic appeal to Aussie and Harriet America?
Always, Ian, it's the people who can speak to the emotional needs of the electorate who...
Well, there you go, back to the heart.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, as I said, in this case, I would go back to sort of the fear center of the brain. But yeah, I mean, the people who speak to the emotions, you know, people don't vote on so much on policies and issues. They vote on their emotions. And you know, in that case, Gingrich would definitely have it. And the other thing is, even if Gingrich does not win the nomination, by being so blatant in his attacks on his descriptions of everybody who's not basically a white male, he has cleared the path for whomever is the nominee to pick that up. You know, people who wouldn't have gone that far before actually will probably need to in order to, have a shot at winning the general, because the path has been laid by Gingrich.
So what do you think, though, in terms of election prediction punditry, Adele, where the progressive base that helped elect Obama in 2008 in a sweep, a lot of that's eroded. Ironically, right. The Democrats are so feckless that they have allowed Ron Paul to peel off a lot of young voters anti-war voters. But you've still got a big sort of progressive liberal bloc that are dissatisfied. And there's a theory that, of course, America is really a centrist country. So there's this idea that the vast center is out there to be tapped, and Americans elect, run by a former colleague of Michael Milken, Peter Ackerman. they're, I think, going to try and peel off some of Obama's voters,
right?
With a kind of Bloomberg type candidate. It's possible that Paul will run as a libertarian, and that would, of course, hurt the Republicans. But going sort of navigating through that, what would happen with the Gingrich nominee? He might actually get the liberals out of their kind of funk and vote.
Well, that's true. I mean, I hadn't thought that all the way through, to tell you the truth, Ian. And Gingrich might put a little energy into the liberal base of the Democratic Party, where Obama is experiencing an enthusiasm gap, as the pundits call it.
Right, and they may find Romney acceptable because he's not a crazy, right?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest, the elections are generally fought over what are called swing voters. And, you know, a lot of people voted for Obama rather reluctantly, whether it was because he was black or because he was painted as this kind of radical, the last time around, but, you know, in more in whispers, And they voted for him because they couldn't bring themselves to vote for Bush after Bush had wrecked the economy and tanked their
foreign. You mean vote for McCain?
Yeah.
Or Bush's surrogate, right?
I mean, I'm sorry, Bush's surrogate. Yeah, they couldn't, after Bush had tanked the economy and McCain went and said that it was, you know, the fundamentals of the economy were sound. I mean, people weren't going to vote for him. There is a segment that held their noses and voted for Obama. Whether or not Obama can get those people back again with the economy still, in not good shape.
Well, they won't get him back if Romney's the nominee. He's the ideal guy for them. But they might get them back if Gingrich is the nominee. Right?
I don't know. I honestly don't know, because it's 4 years later in a bad economy, you get people who are feeling pretty angry and frightened. And that is, the perfect Gingrich voter, somebody who's angry and frightened.
Well, Adele, I thank you for joining us. It's something, obviously, we may be getting ahead of ourselves, but it's...
How can you not help it? It's so not.
It's so bizarre, right. Yeah. I thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me in.
Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's AltaNet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has served as a columnist and blogger for The American Prospect Online, a featured essayist for The Guardian's Comment is Free site, a contributing writer to Mother Jones, and Washington correspondent for Working Women. She has an article at AltaNet.org, Gingrich and Race Baiting Wins in South Carolina. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about China's Iran dilemma. I'm guessing we wandered to-
too close to the water. The current's been sweeping us in. I'm just waiting on you to bring yourself to justice. Forget about the past, it's all with us. I'm just waiting on you to know we've been discovered.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Min-Sing Pei, who is the director of the Keck Center for International Strategic Studies and a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. His research focuses on democratization in developing countries, economic reform, and governance in China and U.S.-China relations. He's the author of From Reform to Revolution, The Demise of Communism in China and the Soviet Union, and China's Trap Transition, The Limits of Developmental Autocracy. He has an article at the BBC, China's Iran Dilemma. Welcome to Background Briefing, Min-Sing Pei.
Thank you for having me.
And your article suggests that it's not an open and shut case, as we've always assumed that China will back Iran no matter what, given that Iran is China's third largest supplier of crude oil, about 500,000 barrels a day. You're suggesting that China is actually in a bit of a dilemma here. Elaborate, if you will.
Oh, absolutely. I think China is in a pinch. On the one hand, it has enormous economic interests in Iran. As you said, China imports about 500,000 barrels of oil from Iran every day. China has also signed deals worth tens of billions of dollars in energy deals in Iran. So Iran is a very important economic prize for China. But at the same time, China has other important trading partners, such as the U.S. China exports $350 billion a year to the U.S., and that exports dwarf China's interests with Iran. And even in the energy field, China has another more important trading partner. That's China's top source of imported oil. That's Saudi Arabia. The Saudis do not want the Iranians to get nuclear weapons. And the Saudis are telling the Chinese, do not help Iran.
So given that today the Europeans announced that they're joining in the boycott, which apparently, according to the International Energy Agency, will start biting in mid-2012, what they mean by it start biting, it means that the price of oil is going to go up for everybody. And it's already happening now, over $110 a barrel now. So surely China must be looking at that as well.
Well, of course, China is worried about the rising prices of oil. But China is even more worried about the closing of the Strait of Hormuz if there is military conflict. So if you have to pick less of the two evils, China would pick rising oil prices rather than a war in the Middle East. Here, of course, we're thinking in terms of using the sanctions to buy some time. And perhaps the Iranians will come to the table.
Well, in your article at the BBC, China's Iran Dilemma, Min-Sing Pei, you suggest that China may actually change its mind if there was a boycott. First of all, you suggest that had this boycott been arranged through the United Nations, the Chinese probably would have gone along with it. But since it's largely a U.S.-European-led effort, they're not. But if Japan and South Korea join in the embargo, you're suggesting that China will sort of start reducing its imports from Iran under various pretexts.
Oh, absolutely. China would never say that it cuts oil, it's cutting oil imports from Iran because of Western pressure. That would be losing face, and then would be admitting that China is acting under duress. China would will use any excuse. Oh, the Iranians are not living up to their promises. So we've found better deals elsewhere. The Chinese will find the excuses. But the bottom line is China will be cutting its oil imports from Iran gradually.
So what kind of diplomacy, you think, is China engaged in with Iran, given Iran's isolation? I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of their influence over the Iranian leadership. Some analysts I've had talking about this situation, clearly there's a kind of covert war going on, certainly from the point of view of the Israelis, with they're the likely suspects in the killing of these Iranian nuclear scientists. Naval exercises, joint U.S. naval and Israeli naval exercises were cancelled, but the Iranians are going to be doing another naval exercise in the Gulf. They've already talked about shutting down the Gulf. What kind of influence do you think China's having on Iran behind the scenes? Because all of this pressure is being brought on Iran because of its alleged nuclear program, and all they have to do is open that up and it all goes away, presumably.
Well, China understands that the Iranians, if the Iranians are determined to get hold of nuclear weapons, nobody can stop them. This is very realistic. But at the same time, they want to avoid a military conflict. So this is perhaps what they're telling the Iranians. First of all, do not even think about closing the Strait of Hormuz. We will be victimized. We will be a victim, and you will lose a very important friend. Second, the Chinese will say you should go, you should comply with International Atomic Agency's request for inspections. If you cooperate, we can help you at the United Nations. That's why China insists that all sanctions have to go through the United Nations. That's where China can, along with Russia, be helpful to Iran. And so they try to dispel any notion the Iranians may have that China will use its influence to protect Iran.
So China, though, recognizes the double standard here, that the West and the U.S. are pushing Iran to the wall to reveal its nuclear program that most analysts say is well off from developing a nuclear weapon. But, you know, there's always the possibility of a surprise. Nevertheless, Israel has an extremely mature nuclear arsenal that nobody talks about. So if this were to go to the U.N. Security Council, would China insist that Israel reveal its nuclear arsenal as well?
Oh, no, China will not, because China, first of all, China does not have a dog in this fight. being subject to a double standard itself, China knows that this is something it should not really get hung upon. So it's, if it goes to the UN, China will try to buy the Iranians more time. China's philosophy, if somehow you kick the can down the line, the problem will get solved.
So what is China's attitude then to nuclear proliferation? Because after all, and this was some time back, but the Chinese provided the Pakistanis with designs for a working nuclear weapon, which is the basis of the Pakistani arsenal, which incidentally is the fastest growing nuclear arsenal on the planet. It has apparently already outstripped France and maybe even outstripped England in the number of nuclear weapons that the Pakistanis are manufacturing. And I think it's a reasonable assumption, given the insecurity in the world today, that it's the most likely nuclear weapon to go off in anger since Nagasaki in 1945 might well be a Pakistani nuclear weapon.
Oh, I think in the case of China's help for Pakistan, that was largely because of India. China's strategy was to prevent India from completely dominating the Indian subcontinent, the South Asian subcontinent. So that was a very deliberate act. Until very recently, China basically had a hands-off attitude. Now its policy on non-proliferation is changing. It is not going to be a proliferator, but it is not going to do a whole lot to counter proliferation. There's a huge difference. China views the task of preventing the spread of nuclear weapons mainly as a burden of leading Western countries. If China can help, China will do something, but China will not be on the forefront in helping Western countries in preventing the spread of nuclear weapons.
And again, I'm speaking with Min-Sing Pei, who's the director of the Keck Center for International and Strategic Studies and a professor of government at the Claremont McKenna College. His research focuses on the democratization in developing countries, economic reform and governance in China and U.S.-China relations. He has an article at the BBC, China's Iran Dilemma, and we're speaking about China's influence over Iran, given that the Europeans have joined in with the U.S. in tightening their embargo on Iran, particularly in the banking sector. Today, the U.S. Treasury announced sanctions against Iran's third largest bank, and meanwhile, the Israelis are apparently are conducting covert warfare, which the U.S. has recently tried to distance itself from. There is a diplomatic track going on between the U.S. and Iran behind the scenes, I understand. But would China have any influence over Israel at all? You mentioned in your article
very little.
That there's a concern that Israel is going to launch a preemptive strike against Iran's nuclear facility.
Yeah, well, China may convey its concerns to the Israelis, but the Chinese know that what they say makes very little difference. If the Americans cannot stop the Israelis, nobody can.
And that is, of course, a major question. What did you make of Hillary Clinton going public after the most recent killing of the Iranian nuclear scientist? Actually, he wasn't a scientist. He was an organizer of the program, apparently. They went public and said, we have nothing to do with it. My understanding is that Hillary Clinton and Obama were quite annoyed with the Israelis. They felt the timing of that killing coincided with the meetings that they were taking place in Turkey between the U.S. and senior Iranian leadership. And then the U.S. canceled the joint exercise with Israel. So how would you interpret that?
Well, I would say that obviously that statement by Secretary Clinton shows to some extent American unhappiness with a much more aggressive approach adopted by the Israelis. At the same time, I would also say that just in terms of defending America's moral standing in the world, the U.S. has to come out publicly to denounce assassinations and similar terrorist acts. So I'm not surprised at all with that kind of diplomatic act.
And Min-Sing Pei, what do you think, though, is the likelihood? You say that in your article at the BBC, China's Iran Dilemma, that China is doing a balancing act because it has good relations with Saudi Arabia, which it's recently improved with the visit by Premier Wen Jiabao. Everybody seems to think that the Saudis are going to make up for the shortfall. Geithner was recently in Japan, where the finance minister in Japan said that we would join an embargo, and then the prime minister contradicted him. I understand that the Americans are trying to get the South Koreans to go along with it as well. They tried with India. India refused. But behind the scenes, the assumption is that the Saudis are the ones that are promising to make up for the shortfall. Do you think the Saudis can make up for the shortfall?
Well, I'm not an energy expert. I think the Saudis certainly have some spare capacity that they can call upon. But whatever the Saudis can produce, the uncertainty in the oil market has increased a great deal. The Saudis may, at the end of the day, deliver 2.5 million barrels of extra oil. I think the common understanding is that the Saudis can only do 1.5 million. Maybe the others can chip in the rest 1 million barrels, because the Iranian supply for the oil market is about 2.5 million. But, you know, nobody knows. But even, as I said, whatever the Saudis do, there will be a period of price gyrations in the market, and nobody who consumes oil wants to see that, the Chinese included.
Well, but it doesn't exactly hurt the Saudis. It's just a high price of oil.
No, it doesn't hurt the Saudis. The Saudis will love it. The Russians will love it. The Venezuelans will love it. Right. Anybody except the oil-consuming nations.
Sure. But my understanding is that with this European embargo that began today, that the Greeks, the Italians, and the Spaniards all complained that this was going to hurt them, and they have financial and economic troubles of their own. So the assumption would be that somehow the Saudis or others have made a promise to make up for the shortfall. Is that your understanding?
Oh, yeah. The Saudis have promised behind the scenes to make up the shortfall.
But they couldn't handle China on top of Greece, Italy, and Spain.
Well, China wants a preferred place in the line. So that's because China's we're the biggest importer. We're the most important geopolitically. If you really want us to put pressure on the Iranians, give us oil first.
I see. So that would be the game that you think would be played.
Yes, yes. And probably the Chinese will ask for some discount. Being good businessmen themselves.
Well, but isn't that the attraction of Iranian oil, that the Iranians are offering discounts? And they offer...
The Iranians are not offering discount. Recently, China has reduced its imports because the Chinese are demanding a discount. They said, importing from you, we pay a price. That's why you have to give us discounts.
Oh, I see. So the shoe's on the other foot then. The Chinese are saying, you're the bad guys on the block, so you should give us a break. Well, just in closing, Wen Xingpei, my understanding is, though, that the economic arrangements between Tehran and China, or Iran and China, since China's Iran's largest trading partner, are quite deep. Not just in the oil, but I understand that to some extent there's been a bartering arrangement with China for the oil, bringing in consumer goods, which China manufactures now that the U.S. that no longer has its manufacturing base. And everybody that I talk to that spent time in Iran recently say that everything in Iran is made in China. So give us a sense of where that stands and how that might be affected.
I don't think that will be affected at all. I think the Chinese policy is to minimize what it has to do under Western pressure. So if it's oil imports, China will cut some, but not completely. If it's financial dealings, China will comply to the extent it is. It does not feel the real pain. Other economic trading activities, China will not comply.
And what about the bartering? Is that fairly extensive?
Bartering will continue. Bartering, if it's not oil, then what the Iranians have to barter. I think they will have an argument over the goods with which they're going to barter with.
But at this point, it's true, isn't it, that Iran is a huge...
absolutely. And, of course, if the isolation of Iran only gives China more bargaining power because it can demand better prices.
And just in terms, in a broader picture, just in closing, Wen Xingpei, isn't there's a lot going on in terms of China's strategic plans in terms of securing not just the oil, but the sea lanes of communication, the pipelines, and to that extent, they're building a pipeline in Myanmar, Burma, directly to China to cut down the flow, and means that the Chinese tankers won't have to go through the choke points at the Straits of Malacca. And all the way through the Pacific. They're also, aren't they building pipelines across the stands as well?
Well, they already have a gas pipeline that imports gas from Kazakhstan. Not oil yet, but a Russian oil pipeline has been completed. And is now supplying China.
And is that through the stands or is that through Siberia?
No, that's direct from the Russian Far East.
Oh, from Siberia.
Yeah, from Siberia.
I see. And that's bringing oil in?
That's bringing oil.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the Russians need to invest a lot in Siberia in order to ramp up production.
Mm-hmm. And
so China can get more oil imports from Russia in the future, but not immediately.
And when do you think the pipeline in Burma will be completed?
Well, I'm not following that. I think it's still way in the future because the terrain is extremely complex. We're talking about very high mountains.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, in summary, China is actively investing in.
I think if you sit in Beijing, probably you would do the same.
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us here today.
Okay, you're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Minxing Pei, who is the director of the Keck Center for International Strategic Studies and a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. His research focuses on democratization in developing countries, economic reform and governance in China, and U.S.-China relations. He's the author of From Reform to Revolution, The Demise of Communism in China and the Soviet Union, and China's Trapped Transition, The Limits of Developmental Autocracy. He has an article at the BBC, China's Iran Dilemma. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about pressure on Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and a member of the School of International and Area Studies. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
It's a pleasure being with you.
And the Arab League on the weekend called on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to step down and allow a transitional government to take his place, all but they unanimously agreed upon except for Algeria and Lebanon. Of course, immediately the Syrian regime rejected this as a foreign and conspiratorial scheme. What is the likelihood, though, of this new effort on the part of the Arab League to succeed? Because they say they're going to try and get it before the United Nations National Security Council.
Well, what we're seeing is a lot of posturing, I believe, by the Arab League. There are tons of divisions in the Arab League. They don't want to throw their hands up and say we've failed. But these two camps that you're talking about, there is a camp that doesn't want to see foreign intervention in Syria. As you mentioned, Lebanon and
Algeria.
But yeah. Also, Iraq is in there as well, because Iraq has aligned itself with Iran. It's a Shiite-led regime. It looks sympathetically at the Shiite-led government in Syria. And so there are a lot of divisions within the Arab League, but even within the Gulf countries, the Sunni Gulf countries, who want to see Assad fall and Syria move out of Iranian orbit into the Saudi orbit, there is deep disagreement. The Emir of Qatar has called for Arab military intervention in Syria. This, I think, frightened the Saudis. The Saudis don't want to see Arab countries begin to intervene for democracy. There's a bit of the glass house syndrome with Saudi Arabia.
Now, my understanding is that already the Qataris are intervening, and that they, as you know, Joshua Landis, they intervened rather aggressively in Libya, and that there's a brigade, I think, that was trained in Libya that are now in Turkey helping the Free Syrian Army.
Well, I'm not sure, the level of Qatari intervention and aid is unclear as of yet. But it does seem there's a lot of arms getting to the Syrian opposition, and there is aid in Turkey. The question is, the Saudis withdrew from the entire monitoring process and have said that they want to turn the whole thing over to the UN Security Council. So rather than searching for an Arab League answer for Arab intervention, the Saudis have tried to short-circuit that and turn to the UN. And that's going to weaken this whole process, because the UN is not going to find any more unanimity than has the Arab League.
But the Saudis are reacting to this rather feckless effort on the part of the Arab League to send in monitors, aren't they?
Well, they have. I mean, they've said that they don't want to have anything to do with it. Now, they're turning it over to it's a hot potato. They're giving it to the UN. But the UN doesn't want it. What's the UN going to do with this decision? They're not going to move against Syria. The NATO is not going to sign up, because Russia and China have insisted they're going to veto any sort of Chapter 7 move by the Security Council. That means America is not going to lead the way and bomb Syria. Neither is NATO. They both said they're not going to do it. Now, possibly, Obama would feel compelled to back up a military intervention if it were led either by the Arab League or by Turkey. And then he could lead from behind, as he did in Libya, and not step on his own campaign rhetoric, which is that he's moving out of the Middle East, not into it. And so it's a bit of a you first situation. The Arab League is turning to the UN, saying, you do something, and the UN is looking to local actors to lead the way in any kind of a military intervention.
Again, I'm speaking to Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He also writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. But surely, Joshua Landis, there's a lot of steps in between military action, which I don't think anybody has seriously suggested is on the table or on the wish list, and this effort on the part of the Arab League to come up with that at least set these demands before the United Nations that the Syrian Assad regime step down and some kind of transitional government is put in place.
Well, there are, and a lot of those steps have been taken. There's the rhetorical steps of condemnation and getting world to condemn Assad, which has largely everybody has done that. Then there is the economic moves, and the U.S. has put rather strict sanctions on. The EU has followed and is refusing to import any more Saudi oil. There are banking restrictions, trade restrictions. Senator Schumer, two New York representatives have just floated a bill for even more trade sanctions against Syria. So there are lots of intermediate measures. The trouble is the Syrian army remains quite strong and lethal. It has helicopters, tanks. It's a professional army. For the Syrian opposition to organize a professional army that can destroy the Syrian military is going to be a long and difficult road ahead. As we've seen in the Middle East, the only times Middle Eastern armies have been destroyed, it's been done by the U.S. and NATO, going in with much superior weapons, whether it's in Iraq or Libya. In the other cases, it was the Arab armies that turned against their dictator. So this is, the Syrian government is in a pretty strong position unless some big Western army goes in and destroys it.
But Joshua Landis, what about the Syrian army being destroyed from within? Already you've had defections.
Well, it's happening. And it is happening. The economic situation is deteriorating. There is an insurgency. But the insurgency is getting better weapons because the outside world is beginning to fund it. And so we're seeing Syria slip towards civil war. The central government is weakening. But the insurgency can't defeat this military. They can do some damage. They can kill people. And already we've got to sort of a 3-to-1 death rate. In other words, the Syrian opposition is saying their people have been, you know, that about 6,000 Syrians have been killed, 6,000, 7,000. And the Syrian government is saying about 2,000 of their security and military people have been killed. So it's about a 3-to-1 ratio, and that, unfortunately, could go on for quite some time.
But since the country is, 10 to 15% Alawite and 85% Sunni and Christian and Kurd, presumably the military is pretty much along those lines. And even though the Alawite officer corps controls the military, and Bashar al-Assad's brother Maher controls the most lethal division that's doing a lot of the killing, and then they have all these, they have the ghosts, whatever they're called,
the Alawite Special Forces.
So, what's the possibility then of the rift that's national being reflected in the army?
Well, the thing is, yes, it's about 12% Alawite. Then there's 10% Christian. There's another 3-4% minorities, Druze, Ismailis, most of which support the Assad regime and are fearful of Islamic fundamentalists taking over and persecuting them in some way. Then there is a class issue. Not all Sunnis are against the government. And because wealthier Sunnis, and particularly urban wealthy, are quite anxious about this revolution because the leadership of the revolution is not obvious. Who's going to take control of the country? And the rich are, in a sense, fearful that country poor will have a greater say, and they'll lose their things will be chaotic, and they don't want to see. They're anxious about that. So the situation has not deteriorated yet to where it's just Alawites fighting against the rest of Syria. It's divided, and certainly the government represents a minority of represents the minorities more than it represents the Sunnis. The Sunnis are increasingly turning against this government. But
you know, Joshua Landis, this really does give a lie to the neocons' latest claim that the Iraq was a great thing. In contrast to the obvious reality that George Bush handed Iraq over to Iran, and you mentioned earlier that the Iranian supported government in Iraq are the ones that have supported. Al-Assad, and they still do. But the neocons are now saying that, we're actually responsible for the Arab Spring because of what we did in Iraq. Well, the opposite is clearly true. What we did in Iraq serves as a deterrent against the Syrian revolution because the Christians and the minorities don't want to see what happened in Iraq happen in Syria.
Well, that's true. People are anxious. They do not want to be like Iraq. Iraq did not become the shining example that it was meant to become and draw the rest of the Arab world towards it. It's a cautionary tale. People are very anxious lest they become like Iraq. And still, there's just recently some articles on Iraqi refugees in Syria. And most of them are staying put. They still see Syria, despite the sort of incipient civil war there and all the difficulties, as better economically for them and less dangerous than going back to Iraq. At least that's what many of them said. And they're staying put, which is a bad advertisement for the situation in Iraq.
Well, I recently spoke with the former CIA officer, Robert Baer, who spent a lot of time with Hezbollah and in Syria and in Iraq. And he's the character that George Clooney played in the movie Syriana. Right. And he's told me that he's been in touch with the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, and in fact they asked him to talk to the State Department, saying, "How come the State Department won't talk to us?" And then Bob asked them, "Well, what are you going to do about the Alawites and the supporters of this regime?" And the spokesman for the Brotherhood said, "We're going to kill them all," and to which Bob said, "Well, maybe that's why the State Department won't talk to you."
Well, I'm usually in their public pronouncements, they don't say that.
Of course,
but I'm law this, yeah. That they will that the people who've committed crimes will go to jail. Now, on the other hand, there are a number of rather fundamentalist preachers who have who have complicated the situation a great deal by making these extravagant claims about what will happen to the Alawites. One fellow named Araud, who's based in Saudi Arabia, has said that they would, once the Alawites were defeated, that they would be ground into hamburger meat and fed to the dogs and things like this. And these sorts of outlandish statements have caused great anxiety amongst amongst Alawites and minorities in general. So the situation in Syria is not just one of democracy and getting rid of a regime which has become increasingly tyrannical and which is killing its own people. There's no denying the oppressiveness of this Assad regime. But unfortunately, this Arab Spring has taken on elements of an ethnic struggle and a religious struggle that are going to make it very difficult in the future.
So, Joshua Lennis, what do you think is going to happen? Is it just going to be more of the same then? It's just going to be a stalemate with this Free Syrian Army gradually picking up more and more army defectors? I mean, obviously the Alawite Officer Corps keep them locked down on bases. They keep guns out of their hands. And Russia, as you mentioned, supports them in every way it can. I don't know that China is actively supporting them, but they certainly will on the Security Council. You don't give much chances then for the new Saudi efforts and the Arab League efforts to bring
about? Well, in the long run, I think this regime is doomed. It's a minoritarian regime, and we've seen, you know, in a sense, what we're seeing, if we want to put it in a larger context, is the end of a post-colonial era in the Middle East. After the Second World War, after the British and French withdrew from the Middle East, in every country in the Levant, minorities had been helped and to the forefront, and they took power. In Lebanon, it was the Christians. In Iraq, it was the Sunnis, 20%. In Palestine, the Jews took power. And in Syria, it was the Alawites. Now, Israel is quite a unique situation because in winning the 48 war, the Jews were able to turn themselves into a majority in Palestine and created Israel. And but they were the only minority that was able to turn themselves into a majority in their state. The Lebanese Christians were overturned, but in a very bloody civil war that lasted 15 years. The Sunnis overturned thanks to American troops on the ground, but even then they came back and fought a very vicious civil war, and that situation is not resolved yet. Now, Syria is the last minority-dominated regime in the region.
Well, Joshua, we're running out of...
So I think that, you know, they are a minority regime that's going to fall, but on the other hand, this is going to take a lot longer. If there's not going to be foreign intervention, the opposition has a lot of heavy lifting to do and has to get organized. It's very divided.
Right.
And a long way to go.
I thank you so much for joining us, Joshua Landis.
Pleasure.
Again, he's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and he writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. And I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now. One time.